Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Generation Kill, Ed Burns' and David Simon's new HBO miniseries, tells the story of the first Recon Marines, who are at the forefront of the U.S. invasion of Iraq on March 19, 2003. Recon Marines were the elite special forces of the Marines. They crossed the Kuwaiti border, traveled across Iraq to Baghdad, in a convoy of unarmored Humvees. Embedded with the first Recon Marines was a Rolling Stone reporter, Evan Wright. The stories he wrote about this young warrior class of elite Marines, mostly in their early 20s, who volunteered to kill or risk being killed, won the National Magazine Award. This hour, I'm joined by Evan Wright, the author of Generation Kill, David Simon and Ed Burns, who produced and wrote the miniseries, and Sergeant Eric Cocker, one of the first Recon Marines who became one of the main characters in the book, and now the miniseries, Generation Kill. So please, join us right after this NPR news break. Steiner Show. Today we're going to take an hour to talk about Generation Kill. It starts on HBO July 13th. It came out of a book called Generation Kill by Evan Wright, who won the National Magazine Award for the series of articles in Rolling Stone when he spent 6 weeks with a Marine recon unit in the very beginning of the war in Iraq. It's about that unit. David Simon and Ed Burns made a movie about this book. They're with us, along with Evan Wright. And Eric Cocker is with us, too. And Eric Cocker was in this battle, was in these platoons, was part of this book, and is an advisor on the movie. And gentlemen, welcome. If I can say gentlemen, welcome. Good to have you all with us.
Thanks for having
us.
Thank you.
Good to see you.
Thank you.
Should I get out of the hills?
Yep.
So where to begin with this? I mean, there's so many places to start. I think for those who have not read the book but maybe seeing the miniseries now on HBO or preparing to see it whenever they listen to this broadcast, that what's odd about this book and the movie is how close the movie is to the book. I mean, most of the time when you see a movie, it's like twisted and turned and characters die, you kill people off, you know, something twists and turns, so it's not the same. But having read the book and watched the first three episodes, the lines from the book kept popping all the way up through. The stories were there. So the conscious decision was made by the men in this room, by the author himself, Evan, and the two of you, Ed and David, not to change things.
Absolutely. I had great respect for the journalism that HBO was bringing to us. And I remember when I was trying to make The Corner, which was a true story, into a miniseries, that there were a lot of sort of Hollywood reasons not to have better endings, to shape it a little more, But there's a power that the true has, and to have played around with this in order to make it a little more dramatic or a little bit more hyperbolic would have ruined what was there. And what was there is this extraordinary story of these guys and what they actually went through. So really the process for us as writers, all of us, was breaking down what was there. And that's, you know, I remember handing the book to Ed and saying, figure out how many hours we need to tell this. But there was no, I don't think we ever had a discussion amongst ourselves about cooking it or making anything fictional.
Well, when I was introduced to David and Ed via an executive at HBO named Carrie Antholis, I talked to a few people in town. HBO owned the rights to it, but other people were still talking to me about the book and what they wanted to do with it. And they wanted to turn it into an action movie or change it. And I sat down with David and Ed and I said, what do you want to do with the book? And David said, with the movie version of this. And he said, we want to make your book. And I was kind of stunned by that. You know, as it turned out, we wound up working together on this, and I was just telling David on the drive over here that had I adapted this, the irony is, even though it's very close to my book, had I adapted this, I'm not sure I would have done that. I wouldn't have had the confidence in the material to do that in the reporting, and it actually took some balls to take that approach to the material because. It's not always the most obvious thing to do is to stick to the truth.
In fact, we'll get into it later, but even the notion of balls is big in the U.S. Marine Corps. We'll get into that later.
But it's true. Nobody in Hollywood ever got rich by sticking to the truth. So, you know, it really does take a certain... It's having a certain window of opportunity, and HBO kind of is that window.
I mean, because part of the power of this, I mean, it seems to me, is the work that you two have done, Ed Burns and David Simon, before this, and your book, and the life you lived, Eric, loved and lived back there in Iraq. It's the reality of it that makes the power here. And I think that's something that I think a lot of people in film and media, period, are afraid to just let the reality
Absolutely.
Speak.
Absolutely.
You know, because I mean, when people take historical dramas and twist them and turn them around and turn them into something else, I mean, history itself, all of that is just so exciting and real. You don't have to do that. Right. I mean, that's what this series shows.
There's a power to the real. I mean, Anne Frank is the story of Anne Frank because she really lived. She was really in this garret, you know, in the Netherlands. She really went to a place called Auschwitz. If she was some composite version of herself, if her story had been told in a composite fashion, it wouldn't have the power that it does.
Right.
I mean, that's an extreme example, but, you know, we're using the real names of everybody in Bravo and Bravo 3 and Alpha
in
the movie. I mean, we're just using the events as they occurred and the order they occurred and trying to be as specific and as credible as we can with the facts. And that has its own power in a way that fiction doesn't. You know, there's plenty of places for a good fictional story, but to inherit a book like this and to have gone there would have been a shame.
Evan, were you going to say something?
I was going to say there's a Stephen Wright joke where he says, "Thieves broke into my house last night. They stole everything and then replaced it all with exact duplicates." And there is something about adapting a book where it's interesting you saw this series and you think, well, it is very close to the book. But the truth is, when you actually do the scripts, you're taking the book, making it all the same, but it's all entirely different when you dramatize it. And there's a real trick to it.
But that's probably what your role was, Eric Coker, in all this, is keeping it real.
Oh, yes, it was. It was a very interesting job, actually, when I first read the
script.
How
scripts. Did you get roped into this?
They suckered me into it. I actually went to go take a look at the Humvees, the 15 Humvees they first purchased.
Oh, okay. Go ahead. Yeah, I'm taking guess. I remember David telling me the story. Go ahead.
Yeah, Jacksonville, North Carolina. God bless that place. And there's actually about 5 minutes out behind my house. And I got a phone call to go take a look and see if the Humvees were what we're interested in, if it was what we had at the time. So we took this long road down this middle of nowhere and show up in the middle of, I think, 15 acres and about every military vehicle you can imagine, Amtraks, LAVs, Humvees, Hueys, Cobras, we're all sitting in this guy's backyard. He's just rebuilding them. And we went through myself, Ed, and Lance Samuels and took a look at the Humvees. And they looked what we wanted to do. They're 1986 Humvees. They're pieces of shit, just like what we had over there. So I gave them the thumbs up, and that's kind of how the job started.
So let's take a step backwards here, because I think that for people just kind of getting into this and what we're about to talk about and what people are about to see, or maybe seeing on HBO, is that you need to set this up for us, Evan. You're going over there, and why you went over in the first place and what you ran into and what you actually did, and then we'll get into some more of the nuances of it all.
Well, you know, I had been writing for Rolling Stone for a few years before the war started in Afghanistan and then the one in Iraq, and my specialty was kind of like youth subcultures. I wrote about young criminals, skateboarders, inner-city gangbangers. And when the war started in the Middle East, I pitched my editor on the idea that, hey, the military is like another youth subculture, so I went to Afghanistan first in 2002 and wrote about the army. I was embedded with an infantry unit, a heavy weapons platoon there, and then followed an ODA team into
ODA.
That's like a special forces team into Kunar province, and wrote a few stories about that for Rolling Stone. And then when after I returned, we were gearing up for the Iraq War. I didn't believe there was going to be an invasion of Iraq, but I was in a contract negotiation with Rolling Stone, and I said, hey, if there's a war in Iraq, I'll go there, because I figured they would give me more money in my contract negotiation. There'd be no war. It'd be, you know, kind of nice. And lo and behold, we started to gear up for the war. I went to the Middle East to be ready to embed in January of 2003, and spent several months there with a bunch of reporters and doing short embeds in the North Arabian Gulf with ships doing interdiction there. And finally, there's basically the way reporters were embedded at the time was a sort of lottery system. You didn't have a lot of control. I didn't know whether I was going to be embedded with the Marines or the Navy or the Air Force. I knew I wasn't going to be embedded with the Army because the Army hadn't been happy with my articles from Afghanistan. So they did not offer Rolling Stone an embed slot. I think one of my first article, the subtitle was Greetings from Askrakistan, which was the soldier's name for that country, and that offended somebody in the Pentagon. But the Marines, interestingly enough, knowing that, were happy to have me. And and so
fit right in.
Yeah. So I was, to make a long story short, a couple of weeks before the invasion, I was told you can embed with the 1st Reconnaissance Battalion. I didn't know what that meant, but it sounded interesting. And the reason I went with a reconnaissance unit, I believe, was actually because I did not carry a lot of equipment. I didn't have to file daily or at all from the Middle East. I was a magazine guy, and I agreed to give up my satellite phone and everything else, and I could travel light with them, and I wouldn't be revealing their position.
And you went over there, the 1st Recon, which we can talk about a bit, which is more like the special forces inside the Marine Corps. I mean, it's a very elite unit. I think your original articles were called Killer Elite, wasn't it?
The Killer Elite.
The Killer Elite. And the book itself is Generation Kill. But you went with the officers first, and I read you then said, no, they put you down with a platoon.
Well, the military, you know, the idea to embed reporters came from the top down, and you had guys like Lieutenant Colonel Ferrando, who was the commander of this battalion. He didn't know what to do with a reporter. He didn't know what a reporter would want to do or what my needs would be, and he initially put me into a tent with some officers, and he thought maybe, you know, I would ride along with the headquarters unit a little to the rear
right.
of everybody else.
But you didn't. You ended up with
Yeah, and it wasn't out of some, like, wild macho thing. I knew that the enlisted guys was where the heart of the story was.
And so, Eric, were you guys thrilled when you first showed up?
I don't think anybody really was. for the most part, until they heard that he, of course, worked for Hustler. Our standard policy is actually not to talk to reporters. So we kind of keep our distance from him. And it's funny because actually Brad Colbert, who was my previous team leader in Afghanistan, like stressed that policy. And then he was the one to take Evan in.
One of the things that really struck me in the beginning of the book and made me think of something that you said, Ed, which you can pick up on, which was that this generation of Marines, that the Marines from World War II would never even understand or identify with who these new Marines were and what they were like. And you said to me once in an interview we had about The Wire, when that last part of The Wire was coming out and we talked a bit about it, about how different these soldiers and Marines were from even Vietnam, the night and day difference between those worlds.
Yeah, the thing about the Marines that I met, and Eric being one of the main guys, is that they are probably light years ahead of what we were. We were basically untrained, thrown into war. And Eric and Rudy and Jeff and all the guys, they're superior individuals in every way. Physically, they're unbelievable. Their stamina, their strength, the toughness, what they know about warfare is profound. And unlike any Marine I've ever met, this 150 out of 150,000 Marines, they can think. So now you got guys that are not only superior in every way, but you're now telling them to think, which makes them very, very dangerous and very, very competent at what they do.
And the thing about all this to me was the way the book was done, the way the movie was done, the parts of the movie I've seen already, the way it portrayed your lives over there, is that this is really, and what on this book has a lot of levels, and so does the movie. But one level here is about warriors. It's about young men from your generation who choose to be the warriors of the 21st century. This is what you wanted to do. This is who you are. I mean, even before we started the show, and you were talking about a bunch of things, and it was clear that it's deep inside you what you went through, what you did. I know it's fairly recent, but it stayed in there, and it's like this. There's a warrior ethic that comes out of you when you speak. That is a kind that you really latched onto in this book. I mean, it's really very real.
Oh yeah.
I think people don't get that.
No, Evan was able to, I guess, get that out of everybody. He was able to actually explain it, I think, in very detail of each individual. I think that's kind of what he was gifted with. So I didn't want him there at the time, I'm glad he wrote our story.
I mean, because what struck me about this is, during the Vietnam War, people saw it in the living rooms every day. They didn't experience war, but they saw stuff happening. They saw Americans shot and killed. They saw people being carried out in body bags. They saw guys bleeding on the ground. We didn't see that in Iraq. And we have this, as you wrote, Evan, I think, and you talked about last time we talked, there's this sanitized version of war.
Absolutely.
That we have in America now. And this kind of just mm-hmm. put it down and put it right where it is.
Well, it was sanitized in another way. I mean, let's face it, the military plan to take down the Iraqi regime was incredibly effective. And it occurred with a minimum of casualties on the American side, and a minimum amount of time. The plan for the occupation thereafter was problematic. And the degree to which we sanitized the war in terms of the amount of casualties, civilian and Iraqi military, there was a lot of that. I mean, you know, you didn't see that imagery on television. I mean, in some ways, I don't know if that was a failure of the embed system or if that was simply where they had people embedded with or, you know, but Generation Kill was one of the first times where when I was reading it, I was realizing this is not all pristine smart bombs going in the right place. There are bodies on the ground. They may not be American, but, you know, war became profound again when I read this book. And I thought that was much of the journalism that came out of the war was a little bit sanitized.
I mean, this is not. I like all of you to talk about this for a minute. The experience of this book and the movie so far to me is not about patriotism, so much about reality, about what happens on the ground every day.
I don't think it's mocking patriotism. I don't think it's exalting for patriotism.
Right.
It's basically saying this is the road trip into Baghdad 2003 and. If you're looking for the roots of our American experience for the subsequent 5 years in Iraq, they're here in these early weeks. You start to see the beginnings of the insurgency. You see the potential for sectarian violence. You see the lack of a plan for the occupation. You see the looting. You see the disorder. If it was just hermetically sealed in those first weeks, it probably wouldn't be worth the road trip. It probably would be worth the road trip. The characters and the dynamic is worth the telling. But the book also speaks to the future.
And you said, Eric, one of the things you said before you started this conversation was that the book and the movie, there were no heroes. This is reality on the ground.
That's the way I always describe it. I mean, maybe that's my perspective, but, you know, none of us really consider ourselves heroes. The book doesn't make any of us look like heroes. None of us are jumping on grenades, saving each other's lives. It's telling it kind of raw the way it was. You hear the perspective of Evan Wright traveling with us and what we did. I always kind of say the war is kind of the backdrop, and you're seeing what these guys go through from day-to-day basis under, like, stressful conditions of combat, of making these decisions under stress, exhaustion, and some of the decisions are right, some of them are wrong. But, you know, it was decisions that were made that time, that day, or under those consequences, and that's what you're seeing. Either if it's good or bad, you see it for what it was.
Let me correct something Eric said, which is when he says there's no heroes, that's his own conception of what he did over there. Eric's a guy that when a fellow Marine stepped on a landmine at night and had his foot blown off, Eric's a guy that ran into the minefield, you know, subjecting himself to a lot of risk and carried the Marine out. Some people would think that's heroic, but their own conception of themselves often is at variance with how outsiders would see them. Looking at these guys over there and how they were different than the Vietnam generation or how they might be the same. During the Vietnam War, I believe that, you know, to rebel against the dominant paradigm of society, you would burn your draft card and not serve, and you know, you protested. And I always felt that guys like Eric and people of his generation who I'd written about, you know, earlier in Rolling Stone and not as soldiers but doing other things, these guys that joined the Marines, their form of rebellion was to embrace the Marine Corps and to join the military and to embrace an ethic of self-sacrifice, of service. And that's very different than the dominant pop culture that they were born into and that they were immersed in. So I always felt that as reporters, we were always trying to look at this war and at this generation fighting and just say, oh, it's exactly like Vietnam. It's the same things happening. The guys over there are having the same disillusionments. But in fact, I think that the motivations for Eric and the other Marines were totally different than the people that were drafted into serving in Vietnam. And if you look at the Marine Corps advertising, it appeals, it's, you know, these some of the ads or these fantasy ads where you fight dragons and with a sword and you wind up in your Marine Corps dress blue uniform. Those commercials are designed to appeal to kids who want to become warriors. And it's very different than the Vietnam War and the people that served there.
But you volunteered in Vietnam.
Well, I volunteered. Right? Well, if I didn't volunteer, I would have been drafted. So it's,
right, man, but you volunteered.
I volunteered. I think Evan is right. I think that this is a road. And I think even in Vietnam, there was guys who like went into special forces and Green Beret who were of that same ilk, who were warriors and were looking to express that in some way. And obviously, the military is that way you do it. But in a sense of being universal is that you had always going to have that discrepancy between the officers and the enlisted guys. And no matter how perfect an officer is, he's coming from a different place than the enlisted guys. And in defense of the officers, the recon officers very seldom went in the field. And this because they were fighting this war where they were put in the Humvees and the officers were with them, it was much more difficult for a transition for the officers than it was for the men. So when you saw the good officers, and Lieutenant Fick being our example, you
a
saw—
A Baltimore boy, by the way.
A Baltimore boy from Lutherville.
Right.
Who was willing to talk with people he knew were tactically superior to him. So he would take the advice of Gunny Nguyen and of Colbert and the other team leaders, and they would plot things out. It was, even though it wasn't a democracy.
It was a dynamic.
There was a dynamic there, right, where he would take in the information and value the
but
information.
That's the extraordinary thing that was hard for me to fathom, which is a lot of these guys, a lot of the non-commissioned officers and team leaders, you know, you had corporals calling in airstrikes, and they were trained to operate in small units without supervision, to think, as Ed says. And you then, like, at some point, you're, like, reading what they're capable of, what they're responsible for, what they've been trained for. And then you, like, glance through the book, and you check back, and, my God, the guy's 23 years old. You know, when I was 23, if I could remember, you know, to leave the Baltimore Sun newsroom and still have a notepad and a pencil, I was ahead of the game for the day. You know, the degree of responsibility you could have given me at a 23-year-old is not comparable to somebody who's operating a team behind enemy lines in Afghanistan. So I'm reading this, and at points I'm sort of shocked at the youth involved. And that level of, I mean, one of the things that I hope this series does dispel is this notion of these are the guys who lost out. They're at the fringe of society. They can't find whatever factory job isn't there anymore, so they ended up, you know, lurching into the military, and now they got caught up in a war. That may be true of some aspect of the military, but it's not true of the Marine Corps or specifically of the Recon Marines.
Now, and one of the things about, I think, the show, there are a couple of levels here, too, that are really interesting before we get into the kind of the view of Iraq and Iraqis in this movie, which is really interesting as well, and the cities and the towns that got hit in these firefights. But stay with the warrior culture for a minute and what comes out of this. I mean, it's not a sanitized version of the noble Marine warrior going into battle. I mean, the cursing, the way people laugh and joke with one another.
Well, there's
the singing.
There's no reluctance.
Right.
Which, you know,
what do you mean no reluctance?
Well, we've always, in the war movie, we always play the reluctant warriors, the citizen soldiers.
Right.
All I want to do is win this war to get back to my girl in Brooklyn.
Right.
You know, I don't really want to be here fighting you in, you know, in the sands of Iwo Jima, but, you know, I have to be, so I'll do my job. You know, later for that, this is a volunteer army, and these are guys who have, as Evan says, opted into the warrior culture. for us to pretend from the outside that they're supposed to adopt some sort of false front of, I really want to go over to the Middle East and be in a tent for 3 or 4 months and then have Saddam back down and there'll be no war and I get to go back to Camp Pendleton and all this training that I had and all of this, you know, I don't get to use any of it. That's really what I want because peace is always better than war. That, you know, that's us exerting our civilian ethos unfairly on people that we've asked to do this job.
But so there's a different ethos that comes out of this. And I think it's important because one of the things the movie really touches on and the book touches on is the power of this ethos that with all of its the camaraderie, as I said, the cursing, the gay jokes, in each other's face, wrestling, fighting, wanting to be there, wanting to be in this war, wanting the fight, bring it to me, let's take it to them. I mean, this is something that was inside coming out. It wasn't like, oh, no, don't, as David just said, don't put me here. I'm looking at you, Eric. Go ahead. What do you think? But just a little bit about what that is, what it was for you. I mean, why, what it was about Eric Coker and maybe some of the other guys that you were really close to, that this is, that you were kind of driven into the Marines in your own heart and soul to do this. I mean, you wanted to be there.
We like challenges. We like to be tested, and we like to show that we're the best. I mean, we're competitive in every nature. If that's picking on each other with racial comments, making fun of each other, trying to get underneath each other's skin psychologically, we'll do it. If that's competing against each other, weightlifting or running or swimming or whatever it is, it's what we do. Myself and Rudy Reyes would still today, I mean, we're 28 and Rudy's almost 107 right now. We still compete on who can eat more at the chow hall or who can drink more coffee or who can do more pull-ups. We still compete and we're always still testing each other. We're still making fun of each other. I still text him every day making fun of him. It's
just kind of gay.
I do.
Now you're rolling in a battle in your goddamn chicken suit and J-Lo glasses. You dress like a pimp queen.
I don't dress like no goddamn pimp queen. I wear clothes that are body conscious.
No matter what, for some reason, like Recon Marines will never change. We're always, we like to fight, and we like to always challenge each other and see which level we could, what next level we could take it to.
I'm here with Eric Coker, Evan Wright, David Simon, and Ed Burns. We're talking about the new HBO miniseries, Generation Kill, based on Evan's book of the same name. We're going to take a quick break, so stay with us. We'll be right back to continue our conversation right after the news.
We're going to demonstrate to the Iraqis that we've not come to harm innocent people or threaten their way of life. But if you bump into an Iraqi who wants to fight, you will f***ing kick his ass. This gentleman is our happy hunting ground. CG has given us free rein to initiate contact all along this MSR. There's not a Marine on the planet who wouldn't want to be in your shoes tonight, gentlemen.
Welcome back to the Mark Steiner Show. We're talking about Generation Kill, the new HBO miniseries set during the 2003 invasion of Iraq. It's the new project from Wire creators Ed Burns and David Simon, and it's based on the book of the same name by reporter Evan Wright. The three of them are here with me right now, along with Eric Coker, one of the first Recon Marines whose story is told in Generation Kill.
I have a story of Eric when we were filming in Africa. He went, along with Jeff Carrizales, another ex-Marine who was one of our advisors, they went up the Zambezi River and they demanded to be taken on the most dangerous rapids. And they went down a stage 5 rapid and the raft turned over and Eric confessed that he was the most terrified he'd ever been in his life. And then he paused for a moment and he said, I can't wait to go back, which at that point, that is the mentality defined. Because and you did go back, and it was in the rainy season, and the rapids weren't as good, and you were disappointed.
I was let down. The Zambezi River is no punk, I'll tell you that. I've 62 firefights. I've never been, I wouldn't say scared. Scared's a little strong. I was a little nervous.
But you and Jeff were yelling at the tour guide, you know, you have to kill us. You have to try to kill us. We want to die.
And he tried. He tried each time.
It didn't work.
Nah, he was close.
imagine the civilians that were in the boat with him.
Are you
they
the
weren't
boat?
Alone. No, are you kidding? I know enough not to get in the boat with him.
Unlucky British guy got with us.
He's still in therapy.
So now, and Reyes, we talked about a minute ago, actually has a part in the movie as well as...
Yes, a unique part. He plays himself. There
he plays
was
himself.
No actor that could play Reyes.
What was that line that you have from the book and the movie about his body? And if you look on his body, it doesn't mean
it
you're
doesn't
gay?
Mean you're gay if you look at Rudy and you think he's hot. We
That's
all
right.
think he's hot. That's what one of the Marines told me when I arrived. I was staring at Rudy. I just couldn't believe this guy was real. You know, he was beautiful. And his skin is very soft,
very
by the
soft.
Way. You know, but he, you know, when they were doing the casting, I suggested, and David and Ed understood this already, that, you know, we should give him a shot at playing himself, because what actor could – Rudy is an unreal person. And it's strange, you know, when he arrived in Africa, a lot of the other actors were like, oh, here's a real Marine. Let's pattern ourselves off of his behavior. And you can't pattern yourself off of Rudy and look like a legitimate Marine.
He's a unicorn. He's like, there's only one of them.
He was really that flamboyant.
That's Rudy. You get
just, he brought Oprah's magazine
and a kind
into
of feathered
combat.
Uniform, whatever he had on.
No, I'm serious. The other Marines are sitting around reading Hustler. The Marines reading material was like a little bit, you know, Elmore Leonard books and interesting novels, but like Knife magazine, Gun magazine, Hustler, Jugs, and Rudy's reading Oprah's magazine. You know, this is that says it all. When I first interviewed him, he compared his own journey of self-discovery to that of the protagonist of The Color Purple. And, you know,
that's great.
John Huerta, who plays Tony Aspera in the movie, he had been asked to read for Rudy. And he said, when he got the sides and read Rudy's dialogue, he said, "This is the worst written piece of crap I've ever been asked. You know, this miniseries is going nowhere fast." And then it was only later that he met Rudy, and he realized that the dialogue was straight from the horse's mouth. It was like he had to actually meet Rudy to believe that the dialogue was credible. So how are we going to get an actor to play that right? You know, at some point, easier to bring the mountain to Muhammad. You know,
you know, with Rudy, with the funny stuff and the scary stuff that's in the series, my intent as a journalist and their intent as filmmakers was always to portray these guys as they were, not as they ought to be, not to sort of view them through that civilian lens of how they should be reacting to the horrors of war. It's just who they were and how they reacted to it.
One of another level of this movie when it came to the Marines was what appeared to be the incompetence of a lot of officers who were in the command structure that you wrote about the book that were in this movie.
Some,
not to say all, but some. And but that incompetence was glaring. I mean, it was almost frightening in what was portrayed in terms of some of the men who were leading you all into battle, making the decisions.
Let me say something though about warfare. And yeah, there was incompetence of officers, but there was another incident where Sergeant Colbert later on was out in a field.
He was a major figure in the movie and the book.
Major figure. I rode with his team in Bravo 2nd Platoon. He was the team commander. He was out in the field hunting for observers who were dropping mortars on us. And some Marines from another unit, not officers, opened fire on him with a 50 caliber machine gun.
Right.
And they discharged a lot of rounds toward him. It's lucky he wasn't killed and blown to pieces. And he came back and he said to me, you know, he knew who gave the order to shoot at him, a mistaken order. It was a sergeant, I believe. And he said, you know, this is going to make it awkward when we get back home and we're back at the office knowing that, you know, he tried to kill me by accident. And there's a lot of things in the military. What actually happens, you can have small levels of incompetence, but once you're in a battlefield and everyone's heavily armed, those defects are incredibly magnified. So I often worry that when people see this, they'll think we're slamming the competence of the officer corps. We're not slamming the general competence of them. We're just pointing out that in that environment, small defects are, you know, can be totally lethal to both civilians and your own men.
But
having
fact,
said that,
the fact is, and I think Ed said it best about a lot of people are very good officers in a very pragmatic way, but combat is the defining moment, and for some of the officers, many of whom were not from the recon community, or they had been brought in.
The men
I was just going to say that a lot of the guys are college graduates who grow up in a middle-class environment who might not have ever been in a fist fight before. And, you know, you go to ROTC training or, you know, OCS, and then you're out there. And as long as it's peacetime, you can buddy with the guys, you can do all these things. But, you know, when you cross the line and that first bullet comes at you, if that's not who you are, then you're going to start acting very, very strangely. And the fear is just going to take hold of you. And for one guy, it did take hold of him. But for other officers, they were quite competent. And
yeah, with all those caveats, Eric was under command of an officer who, you know, as I saw him, appeared to crack psychologically the moment we started the invasion. And maybe Eric.
Captain America
was one of the nicknames the men had for him. He was an officer who commanded Eric's platoon. Eric was in a sister platoon to the one that I was embedded with. And he immediately started. He became overly aggressive. He acquired enemy weapons, was firing them seemingly at random, sometimes at Iraqis when it was a little questionable why he was shooting at them. And he also was an avid souvenir hunter. So in the middle of these battlefields, he was running out of his Humvee trying to collect Republican Guard uniforms.
He comes off in both the book and the movie especially, I think, as an absolute fool.
Eric, what did you think of him?
Captain America, I had mixed feelings about him. When I first had him as my platoon commander, I actually liked him. He was actually a pretty sharp guy. And in fact, he was really sharp. He was probably too smart for his own good. But if you met him today, you'd actually probably like him. The problem with him is when put underneath high stress, he always resorted back to his last highest level of training, which wasn't even close to what most of the operators had. And that was true for a lot of the officers. They didn't go through the same training that the enlisted did. They went through their OCS and then they showed up, and a lot of them were intelligence officers. And they didn't have an infantry background. And typically reconnaissance Marines operate independently without officers, except for here in this situation. Now all of a sudden officers are thrown into the situation where they're in charge of us.
To become a reconnaissance Marine, correct me if I'm wrong, but to become one, you have to go through a course, the basic reconnaissance course. It's a school. And to be an enlisted Marine in recon, you have to complete that at some point. But to become an officer, that school, that course is optional. So the recon Marines, guys, and that's a very tough school. A lot of guys flunk out of it. You can't serve unless you've done that, but the officers commanding them, you know, can not have done that. And Eric's commander actually washed out of the basic reconnaissance course. He never made it through, which made things awkward in the field.
Hearing about, remember Gene Autry, when Gene Autry was on television when we were kids, not when you were kids, you guys got a little young for that, but when we were kids, looking over at Ed Burns, he had this, like, this ethic of a cowboy, these 10 things that a cowboy was. You know, there was a lot like, I remember, the things you were if you were a Boy Scout. And there was some about that ethic of the 10 things a Boy Scout does or what a cowboy should or should not do, which is like not shooting and beating up women, not picking on people who are smaller than you, not doing all these things that were kind of full of kind of male valor that were embodied in this too. So it was a flip side of this. People were killing each other. You were shooting and taking people out into this war and battle, wanted to be there. But on another level, it was driven by this almost Boy Scout ethic of what you do and don't do and who shoots first and what's right to do and what's not right to do, even in the middle of battle, that I think is a really interesting kind of story that most people don't get either. I mean, that's something that's inside of there too.
Yeah, there's definitely still a code that you follow, you hold yourself to. I mean, the rules of engagement are so kind of, they're like gray in some areas, and that's where most guys that are, I think, are true gunslingers still, they still know when, actually, the more discipline is when not to pull the trigger. And most guys pride themselves in when they know not to pull the trigger and when they should pull the trigger. And that's where probably one of the things Captain America had a problem with. I think for him, pulling the trigger was like safety for him. It was, you know, it was his security.
His release.
Exactly. Yeah. If he was pulling the trigger, he felt safer. And that's where his paranoia just like kind of was overwhelming to him, and he just pulled the trigger probably at the wrong time. You know, where a lot of us actually, you know, we engage our mind before we actually engage the trigger.
There were actually Marines sometimes brag about their exploits after a battle. And they've been known to do that. There were Marines, I would hear them bragging sometimes about, you know, good shots they got, but I would also hear Marines sometimes bragging about shots they didn't take because they didn't want to harm civilians who were potentially in the way. That's a very unusual mindset to brag about shots you didn't take when you're a warrior like these guys were, and you did hear that.
And as a combat veteran from a different war, Ed Burns, when we talked about this in the very beginning, before I saw the movie, after I just started reading the book, there was a level of respect, and maybe awe is the word, you had when we spoke about men who might have been in Marine reconnaissance, these guys, that was a little different. I mean, it was just, I remember when you first did that, I was really kind of taken aback when I heard you first talking about this.
Well, I compare it basically to, in Vietnam, we were basically throwing rocks. We were untrained. Most of my basic training was in Fort Dix shoveling snow. And to meet somebody like an Eric or a Rudy who has been physically honed, mentally honed for combat is amazing. I mean, the guys in Vietnam, I mean, we went through combat. It was something that, you know, just happened to you. But the intensity, the training, the kicks in, we didn't have that. You know, it was just a matter of what platoon held itself together the best. With these guys, you see them struggling constantly with the rules of engagement, with trying to make it a pristine war, to trying to do it right, something that you can, and you can take great pride in that. You know, what would happen, of course, if the war is the wrong war and the war is done the wrong way, then the pristine starts to disappear and things start to happen, you know. In Generation Kill, you have an actual war. What comes after Generation Kill is a police action. And then that's when the game really changes dramatically, and that's when your training really kicks in. Now you have to have really good, well-trained guys, and because they're going to be under, you know, the IED pressures and the sniper pressures and things like that. And that's the kind of thing that can make you make the wrong choice if you're not well-trained.
Now, one of the things you made very clear when we talked about this earlier, David, was that you were not in any way going to make a old kind of shoot 'em up glory war movie. You were also not going to make an anti-war movie. You were going to tell a story.
Right. I mean, a lot of people involved in this project, not the least of which is me, have strong opinions about whether this war was the right war at the right time in the right place, whether it was justified. All of that means absolutely nothing in the context of this story. This story is about the journey of it's about these young men at this time in this war and how it affected them and how they responded. That's what it's about. And for me to presume that it's an opportunity for me to give voice to everything I think about the war, or for everything Ed thinks or Evan, I mean, I think there's been a lot of restraint on all sides. To credit another element that's not here in the room right now, we did this in conjunction with Company Pictures out of London, British directors, British editors. And that distance, coupled with the intimacy that people like Evan and Eric brought, you know, and their knowledge of the interior story, you wanted that pressure of the interior story forced, the truth's trying to force its way onto the screen. And then you also wanted the dispassion of people who hadn't lived the event, evaluating it as pure storytelling. And so in some ways, having you know, an element here that wasn't even American, that was, you know, certainly empathetic to America. There's certainly British soldiers over there engaged in this mission. But there was some distance as well, and that distance was necessary in order for it to be credible so that it wasn't a political diatribe.
And even though it wasn't a political diatribe, there was an element in this movie that didn't speak to the anti-war sentiment, but was also just about the horror, about what war really is and the horror of what
Yes.
war can be. I mean, when you talk about, the book was full of it, the movie had a lot in it, which was the devastation that took place on the Iraqi people, in their towns,
That is an essential responsibility of the filmmaker, whether you were in favor of the war or opposed to the war, whether it was a good war or a bad war, is to acknowledge what war is and not to clean it up. Because in a way, I think America has been allowed to distance itself from this war almost systematically, not only to remain utterly, on a personal level, uncomplicit with the decision to send young men, you know, to put themselves in harm's way at this particular point, but also, you know, to the cost of the war being sustained by the Iraqis. Whether or not that's justified or not, or necessary or not, is an open question worth arguing, I suppose. But at least acknowledge the amount of damage that is involved in modern warfare.
And there was a scene. Go ahead, Evan.
I was going to say one thing that David and Ed were adamant about was that these things that they experience when the war starts to go wrong, right, and when they see the horrors of it, the important thing was not for us to lecture about this through the series, but to show how this landed on the men themselves. And one of the ways you see this change in them is they start off, you know, Marines are trained to kill. They talk about killing. Before the war starts, everybody wants to go to Iraq and kill. But actually what really happened is once they started doing this, this became something they really struggled with, particularly at roadblocks where they were slaughtering a lot of civilians due to their procedures, not to poor training or to a bloodlust, but they were killing a lot of people, and this started to weigh on the units. And the men that were the trigger pullers began to alter their tactics, often against the resistance of the officers who were more concerned about just following the standard procedure.
Right.
So throughout the series, those changes that we saw happen, we see through the eyes of the participants, not through our own editorializing.
And there's one scene, I think it was in the second episode, and was also in the book, obviously, as well. I think it came in a different order in the book than it did in the series, if I remember correctly. When you were at a town in Iraq and observing what was going on in that town, the sharpshooter was there, but he was drawing pictures of the town. And all of a sudden, another Marine unit came in and just laid waste to the town. And the reaction of the men in your unit and your units, your platoons, was like, you did not partake in the fire, told people to stand down, and were just like devastated by the whole move. And so I think that, and it made me think, I was talking about this the other night to a friend of mine who was a Marine gunner in Nam, who's become a really good author and is a collaborator of mine. And he was talking about, you know, the times when you reach a breach in a war like that, when you'd have decisions to make about, do you stop the other guys? How do you do it? What do you do at that moment when you're stuck in the middle of something? That to me was one of the most, I mean, in the book and in the movie, was the most profound moments. I just maybe stopped both times and just stop.
It's going to be interesting. You're going to watch, this thing's going to come out. I'm going to make a prediction now. It's going to become a cudgel for people on either side of the political spectrum. You know, they're going to argue over, they put this in because it means that. They put this in because it means this. That they're trying to say that the war is bad. They're trying to say the war is good. They're going to take what is effectively a string of incidents reported by Evan Wright and depicted as best we can in Generation Kill and filter it through their own political meanings. It's going to be infuriating for me. You know, at some point, you know, oh, they had them say this because they're trying, you know,
right.
Simon or Burns or Evan Wright or whoever, they're trying to say this, when in fact, that's something that Eric Cucker actually said on the seventh day of the war, you know, or that's something that Brad Colbert said on the eighth day of the war.
We already had that in a little teaser that HBO ran. It shows Colbert greeting some Iraqis early in the war, and he says, thank you, vote Republican. And there were some bloggers who wrote, ah, that's HBO trying to slam the Republican Party, when in fact that was just a joke that Colbert actually made. He was outside the vehicle when he made it,
Dodd is not a second-rate novelist.
You know? Yes.
We're just reporting what was already laid down there in front of us.
With all due respect to David and Ed, I do feel probably the best lines in the series are ones that are just straight from the mouths of the Marines, the direct quotes. Our best creative efforts, when we had to, could not top what the Marines themselves actually came up with.
And to go to the point about blowing up the village.
Yes.
I think when you're really well trained, when you hear a gunshot, you don't, tunnel vision doesn't set in. You're more aware of your surrounding, and then you can make better judgments. If you know, when five policemen shoot one guy who's unarmed with 60 bullets, that's a momentum there of almost like a mob violence going on. But if you're well trained, you know what your bullet can do, and you can slow it down a little bit, and you can take the action that is necessary. But when you're dealing with reservists and guys who are poorly trained, they're going to fire first, and they're going to fire a lot. And the first episode we did, the very first scene, we wanted to get you an understanding of what kind of violence can come out of a Humvee, and it's pretty devastating. So when you make that mistake, it's not like, oh, I shot, you know, my musket one time and reloaded. It's like, oh my God, 700-800 rounds out in a second.
As Fruity Rudy used to say, once you fire a bullet, you can't take it back.
And to wrap this up a bit, Eric, I'm just curious, out of all this, you've been through the war itself, 5 tours, Afghanistan and Iraq, 62 firefights?
Give or take.
Give or take. And then you're a piece of this book that you read, you live that life, and now you're with part of the making of the movie. I mean, where does it leave you now after all this?
I don't know. Jobless, August 1st, I guess. No, it's been one hell of a run, to be honest with you. I mean, I definitely enjoyed my time in the military. I just served shy of 10 years. I enjoyed my combat tours. I've learned more than you could ever imagine. And working on this production has been amazing. You know, I got to relive another deployment, so I don't know if this counts as a 6th combat tour, a fake one, but nevertheless, it was it's been a long 18 months. But, you know, who knows where I'll go from here. Maybe you'll see me in Colombia next year.
Eric Coker, Evan Wright, Ed Burns, David Simon, thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
The Mark Steiner Show is produced by Jessica Phillips and Justin Levy. Our engineer is Zachary Coleman. Today's show was recorded by Nate DeLuca at Clean Cuts Music and Sound in Washington, D.C., and edited by Justin Levy. To hear past episodes of The Mark Steiner Show, as well as more of our interviews, go to our website, www.centerforemergingmedia.org. And for public radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.